Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another episode we have here of Suspense Radio. So glad that you are joining us wherever you're listening, whenever you're listening, however you're listening. It makes it great here on Blog Talk Radio that we are able to broadcast to so many places. I am your host, John Robb. Today's lineup is a stellar one, I got to tell you. 2 hours today, too. And we're going to kick it off with Robert Rothstein, who's going to talk about his debut book, followed by Taylor Stevens, Jeffrey Wilson, and we're going to end it off here today with John Rector. So it's going to be a fabulous show. A lot of different writing styles coming up that you guys will have no excuse now. The kids are back to school. Now you can sit, enjoy, read while they're doing their homework, or give them this for homework, because there's nothing better than reading and listening, and it all starts right now. Welcome our first guest on the show today. His name is Robert Rothstein. He just wrote his first book. His resume from his background of his experiences is extensive. You can go to robertrothstein.com to find out more information, R-O-T-S-T-E-I-N.com. So, Robert, we want to thank you so much for coming on today. How are you doing?
I'm great, John, and thank you very much for having me.
And so,
pleasure to be here.
Like we talked off the air a little bit, you have such an extensive resume in your legal background and the things that you've done in Los Angeles, Beverly Hills, the people that you have represented, that you've now decided it's about time that you start writing some fiction. And so you brought out Corporate Practices, and it's your debut book. So can you tell everybody a little bit about Corporate Practices that might not be on the back cover with your characters and everything else inside?
Sure. Corrupt Practices tells the story of a young lawyer named Parker Stern who has just been named one of the nation's top lawyers under 40 years old. He brings in business. He loves the courtroom, and his law firm has become his family. But then his mentor and father figure, the senior partner of the firm, whose name is Harmon Cherry, is found dead, and it looks like a suicide. And Parker is so shaken by that that he begins experiencing paralyzing stage fright whenever he steps inside a courtroom. What could be worse for someone who wants to try cases than having stage fright? So it gets so bad that he's unable to work. His firm falls apart because Harmon Cherry brought in all the business, the big rainmaker. And so Parker languishes, spending his time hanging out at a coffee house, which is actually owned by his former law partner and occasional lover, a woman named Deanna, who decided to leave the law herself after the tragic death of the senior partner and the breakup of the firm, and she wants to run a coffee house. Then another former partner, Rich Baxter, calls from the jail and asks Parker to represent him. Now, this is a shock to Parker because he and Rich didn't get along. because Rich took the firm's biggest client, which is a powerful, nefarious cult that, that Parker, for reasons that become clear later in the book, despises. At the time of his arrest, Baxter was in possession of a false passport, illegal drugs, hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash. And despite this damning evidence, Baxter insisted he was framed, that Harmon Cherry was murdered. So Parker, although reluctantly and with a little push from his friend Deanna, takes on the representation of Rich Baxter and goes against this powerful cult, which I call the Church of the Sanctified Assembly. And in the novel, Parker not only learns what happens to his mentor, but also learns a lot about himself and his own past.
You know, the one good thing that I love when I read are characters that I like to say are flawed and conflicted. And so what that does is that just adds a lot more depth and character development, I guess, to the story, because not only do they have a lot of things that they're doing outside of their own eternal struggles, but they do have all of their eternal struggles. So when you started writing and going and figuring out, you know, who did I want to be the foreperson of my book here, Corporate Practices, what made you go ahead and pick Parker Stern as that person that would be the head of your book?
Parker, a couple of reasons. Parker reminds me a lot of many young lawyers who are successful at an early age. And I am a practicing lawyer, and a lot of my younger colleagues might not like my saying this, but younger lawyers who are doing really, really well, kind of superstars, I've seen a number of them kind of crash and burn, and that's always interested me. I've always thought that was interesting, and Parker is somewhat like that. Superstar lawyer, five cases in a row representing famous celebrities. He works at a firm that does a little entertainment law, and then he crashes and burns. So that was interesting to me. I also, as a trial lawyer myself, am interested in what it takes to be able to try a case, be able to win, and I thought it would be interesting to have a character with, as you mentioned, John, an external conflict, you might call it, and that is stage fright. It's, you know, the technical term is glossophobia, and there's actually a technical term probably kind of for everything. It's interesting. I just saw that term on some commercial. I thought that
I
thought it
forever.
Wasn't used. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I never heard that.
Yes. So I wanted to make Parker a young character, kind of, you know, to use a cliche, a young man in a hurry who has a misstep, and see, you know, how, if at all, he can recover from that. That's always interested me.
Yeah, because when the one thing about legal thrillers that, of course, a lot of readers always know is like the courtroom drama and the investigators and the leaguer and maneuvering and the things like that. But the one thing that, you know, they really never get to see is the behind the scenes, the things like you talked about, you know, like he was the superstar coming out, doing his thing, and then all of a sudden, you know, you crashing and burning, and what that does, you know, or what that can do to a young lawyer and what it can do for him and later in his career and things like that. So when you bring those aspects of your character, Parker Stern, out, did you have to kind of, you know, did you use maybe some of your own real life experiences, not just from colleagues or things like that, but things that maybe that you experienced yourself going through the profession?
Well, yes and no. Fortunately, I've never had stage fright in court, and I make it my business never to go back and read my own stage fright scenes before I have a court appearance myself. But I certainly used and fictionalized a lot of experiences. There are it's kind of strange. I've always told I don't enjoy writing the legal scenes, the deposition, the trial. I've told people it feels like work, and yet I've gotten a real good response from both lawyers and non-lawyers from those scenes. And so I think what I'm drawing on is the contentiousness of depositions, the drama of courtrooms. I mean, really, any legal case tells a story. You have a plaintiff or a defendant or a prosecutor and a defendant, and you have automatic conflict, and you have sometimes an underdog and not. So an underdog versus a powerful entity very often, just in the usual court case. And I drew on that a lot, I think, to show conflict in corrupt practices. And, you know, I also do like the behind-the-scenes maneuvering. It's fictionalized, but I did try to be realistic and make it plausible.
And you know, when you talk about your background, and I'm just going to read a little here. Again, everybody, you can go to robertrothstein.com and find all these things out. But when you just look at your bio and all the things that you have done, and the people that you have represented, and of course a lot of big names and a lot of, you know, celebrities. When did you decide it was the right time that you wanted to write and bring out, you know, your debut novel? Was it another challenge? Was it something that you thought about for a long time? Take us kind of through that mental process that you decided it's time for me to write.
Yeah, you know, I wrote as a kid, and I wrote poetry up until I was in my 30s, never published, never really tried very hard to get published. And I'm not sure it was publishable, but and then got caught up in legal practice and family and put that desire aside. And then it's interesting that the nature of my practice both stifled me somewhat and then later got me writing. As you mentioned, I do a lot of work for the entertainment industry, representing writers and directors and studios in copyright infringement suits where plaintiffs come in and say that they've been ripped off by most of the time a movie. And I looked at a lot of plaintiffs and I realized two things. Number one, they sincerely believed that their work had been stolen. But number two, most of the claims were completely frivolous. I'm a defense lawyer, but I'm not saying that just because I'm a defense lawyer. And in one sense, that kind of stifled my desire to write because I didn't want to be one of those plaintiffs, you know, who thought that they'd written the next Forrest Gump. That was one that came, or the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and they were just being treated unfairly. But then I had two expert witnesses who were writers and involved in writing. And one is the head of a very prominent writing program, and I told him I wanted to write, and he encouraged me. We became friends after the lawsuit was over, and I showed him what I was doing, and you know, it wasn't great, but he encouraged me some more, and I finally finished a novel. He read it and recommended me to his agent, and I wrote two novels before the, you know, Corrupt Practice is my third. The first that was published, but I was able to get an agent with the first, and he and another expert witness also looked at my writing, and she encouraged me, and I finally really had the courage to go ahead and go forward. So, as I said, I think I was probably delayed by practicing the kind of law I practice, but I also think that, you know, eventually I was enabled and encouraged and got very good advice from people who knew what they were doing and finally was able to realize my dream.
And so was Corrupt Practices like the first thing that you had? Was it the idea first? Did you think of like Parker Stern, did you think of him first when you started writing? How was kind of the inception of the book come together? Was it the plot? Was it the characters, like the chicken or the egg kind of thing?
Yeah, actually I had two ideas, and I think it was Stephen King in On Writing who said that sometimes one idea doesn't work, but if you take two different ideas, you have a story. The story behind Harmon Cherry, the mentor who's found dead, it looks like a suicide at the beginning of the book, is based on the death of a real person, a very prominent entertainment lawyer with whom I worked with in the early 80s. He left the firm, and a couple of years later, very shockingly, did commit suicide, very tragically. Mm-hmm. He represented Marlon Brando and Gene Hackman and Francis Ford Coppola at one time, really at the top, you know, the proverbial person with he walked into a room and the room lit up. So it was a shock to everybody. And that actually stuck with me. I wanted to write about that, but I didn't have a story. And then I was at a bar meeting, and I met an old colleague from my former firm, same former firm, and I asked about one of our former colleagues who I hadn't heard from, and he said, oh, he's in jail. And he was apparently in jail for taking some sort of embezzlement, corporate fraud, and it was again shocking to me that this happened. And I put those two ideas together, and then I had a story. So that's really what came first, and then I decided who's going to be my protagonist. But the two kind of real life events, the suicide of the former entertainment lawyer, and then the arrest of a former colleague that I hadn't seen in 20 years, really triggered Corrupt Practices.
And with a lot of books and a lot of authors, you always have those couple, two, three main characters. Like you have Parker Stern, you have Harmon Sherry, you have your woman protagonist in there. So you have your main characters that are going. But there's always that character when you're writing that kind of surprises you through the process, that has that bigger voice, that has that funny comedic thing that you had no idea that they were going to be that way. What character would you say in Corrupt Practices best describes that type of person in the book?
There's the character I mentioned who owns the coffee house, Deanna, is to me clearly that character. I've had a lot of people, a lot of people tell me that she's their favorite character. And she really is a somewhat of a secondary character, you're right. And yet she's sometimes she's Parker's lover, but mostly she has gay relationships. She is the person who keeps Parker honest. She's the person who actually gives him courage and gets him to take on this case. And she's extremely supportive. She's highly competent. There is a scene in there where she's after left the practice. She's got piercings and tattoos, but she does come to court and does a very good job. So I think clearly Deanna is the character that surprised me, and my readers tell me surprised them.
And now, is Parker Stern going to be part of a series, or are you going to be writing more standalones? How do you kind of see it going in the future here?
Well, Parker Stern is a series. I've just submitted the second, the sequel, if you will, which is now called Reckless Disregard, to my editor. It's scheduled to come out June 3rd of 2014. In Reckless Disregard, Parker is not practicing law. He's a mediator, but he gets a call from a very mysterious video game designer who goes by the name of Ponyard, which is a dagger, and Ponyard's a little like the graffiti artist Banksy. You know, supposedly no one knows who Ponyard is, and Ponyard wants Parker Stern to represent him in a defamation case brought by this movie mogul, because evidently there's this video game out there that says the movie mogul in the 80s kidnapped and murdered an actress who mysteriously disappeared. So Parker takes on the representation, and we go from there. So there is a series. I plan. I have ideas for a couple of more, although they're just germinating at this point.
So it sounds like you're just having a blast right now doing this.
Oh, it's enjoyable, and I get to explore the legal profession, the movie industry, which has always interested me. I'm born and raised in Los Angeles, and Los Angeles is a character. I love the LA-based noirs, going back to Raymond Chandler certainly, and James M. Cain, and the more current practitioners of L.A. noir. And Corrupt Practices, I've been told, has a little noir in it. It's more of a legal thriller, but it's got a little noir feel, I've been told.
Yeah, I mean, L.A. history is so rich and deep, and whenever, authors write about it, I don't think that readers that haven't been to the city really get the understanding of not only how big it is, but just how different Los Angeles is from other parts of the country, because I grew up in the Midwest and I got the East Coast and I've lived in different places. And not only is this the best city in the world I've ever lived in, it's just the most entertaining for the fact of just walking around and opening your eyes and seeing different things. You got 100 book ideas within a 10-mile radius in the first hour that you're in the city.
Absolutely. And, you know, my son, who is going to school back east and just left this morning, was bemoaning the fact that he had to go back. And he said, you know, L.A. is a place, an observation that others made, but it is true. L.A. is a place where you can see the ocean, the desert, the mountains, and all in one day. And, you know, that makes for a lot of possibilities in fiction. It's also, compared to the East Coast, kind of a brand new city. You think of L.A. history really in terms of decades still, rather than in terms of centuries. As you know, if you go to New York, they're talking about, you know, the 1700s at least. My history is probably not good. I've probably blown that. But still, L.A. is still a very young city, and it's got that young feel. So it's fascinating to me to write about, it's diverse. It's very diverse ethnically and geographically. So I have a lot of fun with it, and also growing up here, although I do write about the movie industry, I do know in L.A. that is quite different from just you know, the flash and glitz of Hollywood.
Yeah, and you know, we have a lot of authors that listen to the show, and of course, this is your debut book, and again, we're speaking here with the author Robert Rothstein, and his book is called Corporate Practices, and you can find everything out on his website by going to robertrothstein.com. And so, now that this is your debut book, and you had every debut author kind of has a journey of kind of how they ended up where they were. You know, what was kind of your journey when you were able to finally get the book out? Did you have to go through, you know, a lot of rejections, a lot of heartache, a lot of frustration? Because, like I said, a lot of authors like to listen, and they always like to know maybe what they're up against if they haven't gone through that process yet.
Yeah, I did. As I mentioned, I'm a very bad golfer, and sometimes I'll still, you know, take a swing at the ball and whiff. I call that an involuntary practice swing. I had two involuntary practice novels. there were two novels. Two novels that again, I thought I got close on both. I look back and understand why they weren't published, and I learned a lot from those. I also met some people who taught me craft in the interim, and that's very important. I have a mentor. I'll name him the wonderful writer Matthew Sharp. You know, it taught me a tremendous amount about writing, and even with Corrupt Practices, though, the book that my debut novel, it did take a while, and I've got my wonderful agent Jill Marr kept at it, and Seventh Street Books, which is an imprint of Prometheus. Was fairly new at the time, crime and mystery, and they, you know, after some passes, they picked it up, and I couldn't be happier. My editor Dan Mayer is just fantastic, and it really worked out. But it was a struggle, but I think most of us go to that. And I think actually I've heard many debut authors. I went back to Thriller Fest and met a number of debut authors, and their story is, you know, I some of them consider that I got published fairly quickly, and it's you just have to stick to it and have to learn the craft, I think, and have to be willing to realize, you know, that maybe there was a reason why the earlier novels didn't quite make it, and try to address those from a craft standpoint.
You know, I was at Thriller Fest, and of course we saw so many people, and we're too bad we didn't have a chance to, you know, run into each other. But now that you're a member of the International Thriller Writers Association, which is an organization which is, I think, without a doubt, the best in the world for authors. How have they been able to help you and just be able to sit there and now be a part of this, probably one of the largest fraternities of, you know, in the world with all these writers, and you're sitting in a room that has been, you know, if you just take from McDonald's, you know, billions and billions of stories told, and now that you're a part of this and you get to meet these people, how have they kind of helped you through this process already?
No, it's a wonderful organization, and they have a debut authors program, as I mentioned, and the new writers all get together, and informally we got together for a dinner, and we become friends, and we're just supportive of each other in how you doing with the sequel. You know, I'm stuck, or I'm promoting my book. I was delighted. One of the a fine writer, Barry Lancet, I'll plug his book because it's deserved it. Japantown is coming out in the next couple of weeks, and he lives in Japan, but was visiting in L.A. and came to one of my book signings and stayed, and it was great to see him. It felt great, and so it really is a nurturing organization, and you have really top, best-selling, you know, brilliant writers in the group also, and they all were very welcoming. It really makes you feel like you're a writer, and that's important if you're going to write more than one novel.
Absolutely. Well, I want to tell you, Robert, it has been a pleasure to have you on and to talk about, you know, your latest book here, Corporate Practices, your debut novel. And I wish you nothing but the best and your series going on. So we'd love to have you back to, you know, keep following and see how you're doing through this great journey that you're on right now. And that, I guess you want to say, the next stage of your life.
Absolutely. John, thanks so much for having me. It's been
all right.
Great. It's been great. Thank you,
Robert. And thank you. And enjoy yourself. We will talk with you later.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
So again, everybody, that is author Robert Rothstein, and his book is Corporate Practices, a legal thriller debut novel coming out from an author that has the experience to write legal thrillers, and that is why you need to pick him up and pick up this book and check it out and follow Robert and follow everything he's going to be doing here with his series. It's very interesting and something that I know that you will all enjoy. The one thing that I also want to let you all know is our new radio show that is going to be out called Crime and Science Radio. If you go to suspensemagazine.com, you click on the Crime and Science Radio banner, and what will you see? But authors D.P. Lyle and Jan Burke and their extensive bios with forensics and crime labs and everything that, you know, you need to know as an author or as a fan to know what's real, to know what's not real. You're going to hear it all on Crime and Science Radio. You're going to see the first four episodes we already have up. We have the synopsis, so you know what you're getting into. It's going to be broadcast here for the first time September the 7th at 10 a.m. It's going to be two shows a month. It's probably going to be the opposite Saturdays that we have Suspense Radio on. So it's just another way for us to reach out to the fans and to the authors to let them know how you get it right, how you get it wrong, the inside stuff between the CSI Miamis and the Law and Orders and all those other fun things, and exactly what you need to know. You know, it's what we taped the first episode already, and it's just absolutely fascinating. And so we can't wait for you guys to hear that on September 7th. We're going to be back here with our next author. She is Taylor Stevens. The book is called The Doll. It's a fabulous book. Can't wait to speak with her. So we are going to be right back after these quick, well, not really messages, but it's more like a really good song. Here you go. So welcome back, everybody, here to our next segment of the show. Again, we want to thank Robert for coming on, and now we are going to transition over to our next author. This is the third book in her series with her character, Vanessa Monroe. It is called The Doll. You can find a lot more information out about her by going to TaylorStevensBooks.com. And, of course, yes, her name is Taylor Stevens, and we want to welcome her to the show. So, Taylor, thanks so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
So, again, so we talked a little bit off the air, and this is the third book now in your series. The first was called The Informationist, then you had The Innocent, and now we're on to book three called The Doll, and it's with your character, Vanessa Monroe. So give everybody a little bit, a taste inside what The Doll is.
It's always so hard for me to answer that question because, like, anybody who's ever had to do a query letter will tell you it's so hard to, you know, make a synopsis of a book. It's just easier to write the whole thing. But I think, ultimately, all of my books are about Monroe. They're snapshots and stories of her life. And The Doll is an adventure that takes her to the Adriatic area. She spends time in Croatia and then transfers over into Italy and France. And she's a very badass woman, and people learn real quickly not to mess with her because she has a lot of rage issues. And she is dealing with a human trafficking organization, and all of my books are titled after a key pivotal person in the story, and the story, the person in The Doll, is a woman who's being trafficked, that Monroe is both supposed to save and who, if she doesn't basically turn her over into the hands of death, the people that she loves will be destroyed. So she's faced with a deep quandary, and the story touches on how she deals with it, the quandary.
You know, the one thing that I kind of picked up on, and this could be something that's just like way off base for me, is that when you first look and you look at your books and you see, and I'm just going to strictly off the cover, because you look at The Informationist and you look at The Innocent, and then all of a sudden you see The Doll, as the first two were very similar, just pretty much the same, just changing of the color. And then The Doll is so much different. It might give fans the you know, maybe knowing, hey, is this book different than the first two, or is it just, you know, is it the continuation of her life? What kind of separates The Doll from, you know, like The Innocent? How has she progressed as a character coming forward now in book three?
Well, I think that as a character, I know some authors, when they do series, each book sort of is self-contained, and you can read them out of order, and it doesn't really make a lot of difference. And I try, for the sake of plot, to keep every single story self-contained, but as far as the character arc, it definitely does flow from the first book through, and will continue to flow, because I see her as a real person, and everything that happens before is going to affect how she reacts to things moving forward, and that definitely plays out in The Doll. But as far as the covers, I'm sure, as you well know, after having spoken to so many authors throughout the years, we don't really have a whole lot of say in the cover design. And I think that my publisher felt that this was a much bigger book than the others, and they've always struggled with the covers for these books, because generally female thriller authors receive a little bit of a different reception than male thriller writers. And they were nervous that they didn't want to scare away the male readership. And being too feminine or too overtly open about having a lead female character in a book written by a female author would tend to scare away the men. So to find that balance in the covers has been a struggle, and I don't think they really hit on it until they did the cover for the doll. And once they found that, it seems to me that they're really happy with the direction they went in the doll, and they're actually going to go back and rebrand the first two books, at least in paperback, because this is more of what they were going for from the beginning, but they just didn't have it at the time.
You know, and you bring up a very interesting point that I don't know if a lot of readers really understand. And there was a panel one time, and I'm trying to remember which convention I was at, and I don't remember, but it was Lisa Gardner, it was Erica Spindler, it was a couple other really big thriller authors, and they were all women. And the topic was, why is it difficult for a woman to kind of break into the thriller genre that is mainly dominated by the men? And you kind of just touched on that. So do you think that you have undue pressure by having, when your character is a woman, to make her, I guess you want to say, more appealing to the male reader, or do you not even think about that when you're writing? Because when you put in there, you know, a lot of people that say, you know, Lee Child, Barry Eisel, Robert Ludlum, those are the people that should read your books. Do you kind of feel that pressure when you're writing, when you're doing this?
I don't feel the pressure because I write Monroe as she is. I think where it will come to light, and again, this is not pressure, it's just simply an observation of human nature. I've received quite a number, shocking number of email from male readers who've blatantly told me, I flat out don't read women writers. I just don't. But I make an exception for you. And I'm like, well, okay, thanks. I'll take it where I can get it. I think women, as authors, have a tendency to write male characters the way they would female characters. Women tend to really analyze things, and they get in touch with their emotions, and men aren't so much like that. They just want to get it done, you know, just like get on with it already. And it's not Vanessa Michael Monroe that I write with men in mind. It's that I try really hard to make my men, not female versions of men. And it's possible that in that, that's one of the reasons that male readers, when they do finally deign to open my books, find that they can connect with the characters, is because they're not men written through the eyes of women. But in general, I think it is very difficult for women to break into the male readership, you know, market. But even more than that, I feel that women readers also hold female thriller writers to a different standard than they do to male thriller writers. And this is very general. I'm generalizing. It's not going to apply to everybody, clearly. But just as a sort of a feeling that you get. You get a lot of feedback from people who, you know, either review your books or respond to them personally and communicate with you. And I find that having a female character who kicks butt, she's not really given a lot of the same allowances that male characters who do the same thing are given. When you read thrillers written by men, Reacher, Bourne, you know, Mitt Rapp, and so on and so forth, you know, these are men who are killers, who, you know, they do what they do and nobody bats an eye. But when a woman comes along and does the same thing, she's emotionless, she's hard, she's a bitch, she's a, you know, you can't relate to her, she has no sympathy, and she's not an action hero, she's a superhero.
Well,
and,
you know,
and I find that kind of interesting.
Yeah, and the traits that you just said, being a bitch and being that type of person, I think that a lot of married men that are divorced would say, yes, I can relate to that kind of a woman. So I don't know if that has anything to do with it. They're like, I don't want to read about my ex. But
reader projection.
Right. But the one thing that I find that I fascinating about the book, The Doll, is that you go into a subject matter that is right now, and it's becoming, I don't know if it's because of the Cleveland fiasco and the things that are going on, but human trafficking is one of those taboo things that a lot of people don't like to know or think that goes on. And I think the movie Taken with Liam Neeson was a big maybe eye-opener that these things kind of happen in these kinds of areas. And that was one of the first movies that I can remember, and I'm probably wrong, that kind of made it into Hollywood that was that popular. So why did you decide now that you were going to tackle, you know, this kind of a controversial subject matter in human trafficking to set Vanessa in with the doll?
You know, I get that question a lot, and it has surprised me from day one. To me, I'm like, I don't understand why this is a controversial subject. It's like, this exists. This goes on in our world. It's been going on for forever. Or, you know, do we just bury our heads in the sand and pretend that it doesn't happen? I don't understand what the big deal is. It's like, why is it a controversial subject? There should be no controversy. And so,
I think a lot of the reason is because they say controversial subjects. You remember how the Catholic Church got so, put underwater with the priests and the things that they were doing, because it was people don't like to know that those things go on. So I think that they label them controversial, where I don't think people like to know that human trafficking goes on. So I think they just call it a controversial. They really don't maybe know how else to put it.
I suppose I come from such a completely different perspective on it that it's foreign to me. But as far as why I personally picked that subject, I was dealing with a lot of what ifs, because the premise for the doll started with, what if Monroe wasn't the savior, she was the victim? What if somebody kidnapped her and Miles Bradford had to save her? So with those what ifs, it would be like, well, who would be crazy enough to do something like that? What would be a big enough motivating factor to get her to care? What would be a bad enough situation that she would truly be in a quandary and wouldn't just walk away? And so there aren't a lot of subjects in real life that I could write about and it would work with all of those what ifs. So that's, and I had already been, I mean, I was familiar with the subject of human trafficking. I've read from years back, read articles of families trying to find their daughters, and this mostly took place in Latin America, but it was the same mm-hmm. issue. And the more I started researching the subject of human trafficking, I saw, you know, a lot of it does come out of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet little satellite countries. And so it worked with the locations that I was looking at in order to write. And so it all came together as, this makes sense as a topic to deal with. But I didn't do it as some, you know, advocate or trying to raise awareness or bring an issue to light. And knowing what a deep, deep, dark subject it is, I didn't want to make a mockery of it. You asked earlier if there was a difference between the first two books and the doll and now books moving forward. And there is, in a way, because when the first two books, I had a lot of real-life experience to draw on. I had lived in Africa, which was made it very easy to write The Informationist in that sense, because it was all drawn off of places that I'd been and seen, and I was really trying to write about Africa, and the thriller just sort of developed out of that. The Innocent takes place inside a cult commune in South America, and the entire story is pretty much not fiction. I mean, it is a fictionalized account of things that happened in real life. And I wrote about my childhood in The Innocent. So when I got to the doll, I kind of run out of real-life scenarios that I could speak with authority on. And so I didn't want to make a mockery out of this very deep, dark subject I did not have personal experience in. So I took the doll and I created a situation that probably would not happen in real life. Or if it did happen, it would happen so rarely as to be improbable. And I use that as the entertainment factor and sort of a reflector back at this other subject that I was never a human trafficking victim. I don't have the depths of anguish and the torment that these women go through. But I do know that there are a lot of similarities in a trafficked victim as a kidnapped victim and a trauma victim and an abuse victim and a child raised in a cult. So I could get it, but I couldn't write on it as an authority. So And I write entertainment. I'm not writing an expose. So I built the thriller to be entertaining and to show, to shine a light on this other subject for people who want to, who are willing, I suppose you could say, to do their own research and dig deeper.
So this book was definitely a different kind of writing for you. Like you said, since you're not pulling from personal experiences, you had to kind of start with, you kind of had the canvas not really white, because you already had, you know, Vanessa there. You already knew, you know, how she was and how things were going to go. But you did have more of a white canvas than you did in the first two books because this was a different subject matter. So what kind of was your struggles or your challenges getting through the book, The Doll, since it was written in such a different fashion for you?
Actually, the greatest challenges in writing The Doll is because, oh my God, The Doll is two stories on two different continents with two completely different casts of characters on a timeline that has to zipper seamlessly together in two time zones. And I don't like repeating events in books. I feel it's a waste of words and a waste of reader's time and energy. So I never tell the same story from two different perspectives. I pick up where one left off and zipper back and forth that way. And so given the time differences and the communication differences and everything, I had to zipper those two stories together seamlessly, one always falling back on the other. And I had to keep each storyline as taut and tense with its own adrenaline, and that was not easy. And it was a very, very difficult book to write, and also struggling so hard to keep a sense of realism for things that I had to research a lot, just enough to make sure that I knew I wasn't making a fool out of myself.
And I want to remind everybody that we are speaking here with author Taylor Stevens. And her website is TaylorStevensBooks.com. The latest book out is called The Doll, the third installment in her Vanessa Monroe series. And so for fans now that are just finding out about you, new fans that you haven't had before, what do you tell them as far as when, you know, the question always comes up when you write a series, do I have to start at the beginning with the information, or can I pick up any book in any order and still be okay?
Well, I try really, really, really hard to make these books standalone as far as the plot. And I think that if somebody's impatient and just wants to get with it already, they can start now and they'll get it and they'll enjoy it. But if you're that kind of reader, then absolutely go for it. I'm that kind of reader. I can start in the middle of a series. I don't care. But some people can't. And so to those, I say just start with The Informationist and just understand that every book reads different. I try really hard not to make each one like so similar to the next that you feel like you're reading the same story over and over again. So they do change. The tempo, the pacing, the backdrops and everything all do change. And so it's really either or. It's up to the readers. I am not a patient person. So I would be, and I like to be able to discuss whatever's going on with people. So when people are like, oh, well, you have two books, I'll go and read the first one first. And I'm like, no, because I can't talk about it with you. So I'm like, no, just read this one now, and then you can go back and read the other ones. But for some people, right, it's not as enjoyable of an experience.
But that's good, because, you know, I think a lot of series that are coming out now, a lot of authors are writing the way of, hey, you know what, you don't need to start at the beginning to still understand, you know, what's going on. You can definitely start with The Doll. You can kind of go back and get it, because it's more about the stories than the things that she has to overcome than I guess it is more about, you know, her life. You're not starting with her as a teenager then going through adulthood. I mean, it's more about the things that she has to go through. In every book, she probably has a different struggle and a different inner turmoil and outer turmoil that she has to kind of get through.
Yes. The only difference is that if people really, really want to relate to her and understand why she is the way that she is, they should probably just read The Informationist first. Because, like, some people just can get with it. Like, I can start a series in the middle, and I just take it on the author's word that this all makes sense. Even if I didn't read the beginning and understand the birth of her, so to speak, and all of that. I can get with it. I don't need to read the first Jack Reacher book to understand why Jack Reacher does what he does. I could just pick it up in the middle and get with it. But not all readers are like that. So some readers are like, this just didn't make any sense, and I didn't understand her motivations, and it just ruins it for them. So I'm like, just go read the first book.
Yeah, just be done with it and leave me alone, okay, if that's what you really want to do.
It's not really like that, but I want people to enjoy the experience, and if not getting it is going to be that big of a deal, I'm like, just go read the first one.
Exactly. And so the thing is, are you doing a lot of, you know, events, a lot of touring? I mean, I know that you just came off kind of in June, you were out and about doing a lot of things. So are you doing more, you know, blogging, are you doing more radio, places where people can maybe connect with you and might not be able to meet you face-to-face, but they can still connect with you and still talk with you about your writing and about the book?
I basically will go wherever I'm invited, time permitting. I try and limit it to, you know, specific time frames. Like if I'm on tour, then that's the time that I will be more eager to be out and about, because every day that I'm doing something, in, you know, like being somewhere, I'm not writing, and I get further and further behind on what I'm supposed to do. But where I actually really prefer the most, and I think it's the most beneficial even for my fans and readers, is through email. I have an email mailing list that I always encourage people to sign up on, because I write, I don't blog, but I inbox, I guess you could say. Like, I write blogs, but I just email them to people. Because
okay.
I feel like online and on the social networks, not everybody uses the same networks. Not everybody's always checking it. I'm not a real big blog follower. And I know that there are a lot of people who just aren't. And then, you know, they miss what you wrote. But everybody checks email. So I blog to inboxes, and I talk so much. People have so many questions about the publishing industry and how does it work. And since I'm not self-published, but I guess you could say, I mean, I'm not self-made. I could not have gotten where I am without a lot of help from a lot of people. But I didn't come from a publishing background. I have a sixth grade my formal education is sixth grade. Everything beyond that, I'm self-taught. I taught myself how to write. I taught myself everything I knew about the publishing industry to find an agent. Nobody taught me anything. I figured it out on my own. And, I'm fortunate, I suppose, in the sense that I can assimilate information pretty easily, and I can figure out how to apply it in everyday life so that I can get it to work. Not everybody can do that. And I don't mean that in a conceited sort of way. We all have our strengths and our weaknesses. I can't add. There are a lot of people who can add really well. I need a calculator to add simple numbers, and even then there's no guarantee I'm going to get my numbers right. So, you know, I can do some things that other people can't. Other people can do some things I can't. Okay, so great. I have this ability to assimilate and integrate knowledge and be able to regurgitate it in a way that is simple and easy for other people to understand. So I explain what I know on a regular basis about the industry and how it works. I also talk about my own life and how I got to where I am and the struggles that I went through and the lessons that I've learned and the life skills that I gained. And I talk about funny things and sad things. And those who really want to know me as a person, that's why I recommend that they go, because they will know me better than any newspaper article or any radio interview or any blog post ever can, just by keeping up with my email.
Well, we got about 2 minutes left, and so I got to ask this question. If Vanessa is sitting in front of you right now and you're having a cup of coffee with her, or beer, wine, whatever, what do you want to know about her that you do not know, that you don't know right now?
Oh, my God, what a question. I don't have anything. I would just give her space and let her be, because I know that she mostly just wants to be left alone, and that if she was sitting there in front of me with a cup of coffee, it's not to be my friend, and it's not to be nice. There's something she wants from me.
And that is kind of the portrayal that you have with her in the books, is that she has a purpose for everything she does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, Taylor, it has been absolutely fascinating to speak with you. I want to thank you so much for coming on. You know, contact us anytime. Keep us up to date on stuff that you got going on. We'd love to have you back on, or maybe, you know, any time in the magazine, or just have you back on the radio show. It's been great. I really appreciate
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. And I just want to say, hopefully for any of your listeners who do want to get on my mailing list, I'm really easy to find. If they go to my website, TaylorStevensBooks.com, that there's a connect with me button there, and there's a little web form and gets you right on.
And it's as simple as that. Thank you. You know, the internet can be evil, and I always call social media weapons of mass destruction. But
I
it
agree.
Is good that you are, you know, that you are able to connect this way with people. And you know, some fans are just like, oh my God, I really wish that they would leave me alone. But those are very few. You know, there's not that many.
They're very, very few. And I appreciate and treasure every one of my readers because they're the ones who keep me in business.
Oh, that is so true. If it wasn't for them, we wouldn't be here, and I wouldn't be doing this, would I?
Absolutely. Oh, I agree.
Yeah. Well, Taylor, you have a wonderful day, and enjoy yourself. And, again, anytime you let us know, we'd love to have you on, okay?
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye. Have a good day.
All right. Bye.
So, again, everybody, that is Taylor Stevens. And like she said, TaylorStevensBooks.com to find out more information about the books, to connect with her. Fascinating woman, fascinating writer. You can just tell that she is very much puts a lot of herself into her books, and that's what you want to see as a reader, because it makes it that much better emotionally and everything else when you're able to get a glimpse maybe of the author and kind of, you know, who they are just from their writing. And that's something that Taylor does, and it's just a fascinating way. And I recommend everybody to go out and get The Doll, and without a doubt go back and read the first two, because she will definitely be an author that you will want to follow. So we are going to be back here again at Halfway Point with our next guest. His name is Jeff Wilson, and he is going to talk to us in two. I've always wanted to say this, so I'm going to say it. Chuck Willery, if you remember from, I forget the name of that show, but I think it was a Newlywed Game or whatever. He goes, it's 2-2, right back at you. So here you go, 2-2, right back at you. Again, everybody, I would like to welcome you back. This is our Halfway Point of Suspense Radio, 60 minutes. It flew by, and I want to thank Robert Rothstein and Taylor Stevens for being our guests here on our first hour. And now we're going to welcome back an author that we had on for his last book called The Donors. His latest book, just came out June the 14th. So it's been out for a couple months, so there's no reason why you cannot go out and get it. His name is Jeffrey Wilson, and the book is Fade to Black. Metallica fans are going to love that because, of course, you know, that's one of the great songs they've written. So, Jeffrey, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
Good, John. How are you?
I'm doing fabulous. Again, we want to welcome you back. We talked a little bit last time about your book, The Donors, and now you're back here with Fade to Black. So give us, you know, that off the cover, or not on the back cover, inside look inside your latest book here.
Sure, yeah, easy day. So Fade to Black is probably of my three books, it's the third one to come out, but it's my favorite because it's the one that's the most personal to me. Like sometimes happens in this business, it was actually the first book I wrote, and it's coming out third. But Fade to Black is a supernatural thriller. It's about a man that's a young man who's sort of caught between two realities. In one reality, in the opening of the book, he's a Marine, young sergeant in the Battle of Fallujah that happened a number of years ago in Iraq. And he and his squad of men are in a fierce firefight. He sees several of them get injured and killed, and then he himself receives a horrible wound and is lying there bleeding in the streets during this firefight. Then he wakes up, and he's suddenly Jack Keller, a high school biology teacher in Middle America, and he's got this strange sensation that the dreams are somehow more real than his real life at home with his wife and child. And so he's torn between these two worlds, and the rest of the book goes on trying to determine which one is real and which one is fantasy. Is he losing his mind, or is there something bigger and more supernatural going on?
And when you start writing on different planes and you do these things, it makes it kind of challenging for the author to make sure that it's relayed correctly enough to not really confuse the reader, so they kind of know where they're at in the story with your character Jack and kind of where his time or where his mind is. Is that one of the challenges that you face when you write a book like this, Fade to Black?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, that's always a challenge. I think the real challenge is to not overthink that aspect of it. I think there's a tendency as a writer to coddle the reader, to over-explain, to assume that they don't get it, and then you can make your writing really dry and stiff. And so I think that's the real challenge, is to not worry too much about that, because if you do, you tend to condescend to the reader. And as I can tell you as a reader, I hate that. There's nothing worse than having the author explain something through a scene that you're like, dude, I get it. Come on, move on. So, but yeah, it is a challenge to do it, but it's more of a challenge to do it in a subtle way that isn't tedious for the reader, I think.
So kind of give us a little bit more insight into Jack and, you know, his family and any kind of struggles. It's like, why is this kind of happening to him kind of in the way, you know, that it is? I mean, what kind of struggles, what kind of internal things that does he have to go through, you know, going into the book from the beginning to the end?
Right. Yeah. So the big drive for the main character, whether you think of him as Casey, the Marine sergeant, or you think of him as Jack, is this passionate love for his wife and baby girl. And all he wants is to give them a good, healthy, happy, normal life. Whether it's when he feels that he may be this Marine that's dying in Iraq, that's easy. It's obvious he wants to make sure that he survives. He wants to get home to his family. He wants to be there as a dad and a husband. As Jack, as the biology teacher, the fear is that he's losing his mind and that he'll leave his wife and daughter as he descends into this madness that he feels enveloping him. And so in both of these sort of competing parallel character arcs, there's the driving force is love of family, just wanting to be at home with his wife, his baby girl, and be normal and healthy and happy. And so these two things are sort of developing in parallel, and there's a lot of flashing back between these two parallel storylines as the reader and Jack and Casey try to figure out what's real and what's not.
And the other thing is when you put it in there and you say, you know, that he, in kind of like one world, you know, he's a Marine sergeant and he's kind of locked into, you know, the struggle. and the other, and then all of a sudden he wakes up and he's kind of with his wife, and he's kind of in the, you know, like you said, these two parallel worlds, but they're just so much different. How does he kind of have to handle that mental-wise? Because I'm trying to think of, you know, if I was kind of put in that situation, wouldn't it just almost make you on the verge of total insanity?
Right, and that's the driving force of the book, and the question that he and the reader are trying to answer: is this a guy that's clearly going insane? Because, you know, throughout the book, he's thinking back about how he has never served in the military, doesn't even have close friends or family that have served in the military. How the hell is it that he knows so much about what's going on when he hears these news reports on television about the battle and things that have happened? He's got opinions on it. He's got thoughts about it. He knows the lingo and the terminology, and it terrifies him that he knows that. He doesn't understand why he would know that. And so the drive to believe that he might be going insane is just that. It's like, this is, you know, this is just so outside of the realm of what I've accepted as my normal life that I must be going crazy. It's the only possible explanation, which is terrifying in and of itself. But as the book evolves and he's forced to choose between which of those he believes, am I going insane, which is terrifying, or is it possible that these two realities can both exist, that I'm somehow tied to this other person, or in some way I am this other person, which of those is more terrifying, you know, the supernatural tie to a dying Marine in Iraq, or I'm losing my mind? And he is forced at some point to choose what he believes and to act accordingly, with a motivation of, you know, by taking action, perhaps he can change what's going on and save himself and his family.
Yeah, I mean, and I remind everybody here that we are speaking with author Jeffrey Wilson, and it's jeffreywilsonfiction.com to find out a lot more information about what's going on. And like we said, you know, your last book came out, The Donors, and we had you on the radio show talking about that. And now the latest book, It's Fade to Black, came out in June. Talk a little bit about maybe how you as a writer maybe have matured or progressed your craft from The Donors now into Fade to Black, and any kind of maybe things that you have learned along the way, gotten some advice from some people, just to kind of, you know, amp your writing into another zone, if you want to call it that.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, for me, the evolution is a little bit circular, because, as I said, the rough manuscript for this book was the first book I ever wrote. I actually wrote it while on deployment in Iraq and was plagued by some of the fears that this character has. I was, a single dad at the time and worrying about what will happen to my son if I don't make it back and that sort of thing. But then the book got shelved as I worked on other things, and The Traitor's Ring came out in 2011, last year The Donors, which was very well received and got me some recognition, and now this third book comes out. But definitely what I learned from the first two books through the editing process and the revision process helped me a ton in this book. I think this book, you know, I'm an author, so I think all my stuff is genius, of course, but my first two books, definitely the revision and editing process was much more painful and difficult for me. I think I learned a lot from the first two times going through that process, and it made it much easier the third time to sort of see how the end product would be affected by the revisions that the editors were recommending and that sort of thing. So I do think I wound up with a little bit of a slicker product, something that I think flows a little bit better. And in the interim, you know, your first guest was talking about ITW, which has been a huge force for me as well. I've met so many people there that I've formed relationships with and gotten advice from, and that's been tremendous to work with some of these, you know, big writers and be able to pick their brains and get their opinions. That's been a tremendous source of inspiration, as well as, you know, everyday advice on how to do this, how to do that, even and the business side of it as well. So there's a definitely different writer today than I was when The Traitor's Ring came out a couple years ago, no question about it.
And, you know, and I think that's the good thing, that not only you're fancy, but I think just from a personal aspect that you see about yourself is kind of how, you know, you progressed and how you changed as an author. And it's kind of exciting to kind of know what you can do going forward with different books and different ideas, and use little tips and little things that you know, that you have learned along the way. And IQW is one of those organizations that not only will help you along the way, but any author that is a thriller writer that has not joined, you literally just must have your eyes shut and
oh my gosh,
not care
about
your craft.
You couldn't be more right. What a great organization. In fact, you were in New York this past summer, right?
Yeah, I was.
I think I was stalking you, but never quite found you. I think we kept missing each other, but I had wanted to meet you in person. But Wendy, my wife and I had a great time, like we always do. And by the way, I know that you mentioned it earlier, but I am so excited about Doug Lyle's and Jan Burke's new show. It's going to be fantastic. He and I talked about it quite a bit in New York, and what a fantastic idea! I think it's brilliant. I think you guys are going to have a lot of fun with that. But meeting people like Doug and you know, other people, and then meeting, like your first guy talked about, folks that are at the same starting point that you are and what they've learned and you know, sort of logarithmically increasing the rate at which you absorb information because you're learning from other people's experience. You know, that's what ITW is really about for the young writer, is learning from your mistakes, sharing those with others so that we can all be on this very steep learning curve for the business end as well as for the craft end. And that it's definitely done that for me. There's no question. Best thing I ever did was join that organization.
Yeah, and you know, it opens a lot of doors, and you're able to see a lot more, you know, whether it's blogs or radio interviews, or you know, you're going out into different bookstores and you're meeting new people. What's kind of like the one major theme that you might hear from fans? The one thing that they always like to ask you, sort of like the FAQ that you can kind of get out there about, you know, what they want to know.
There's a couple of things. I think a lot of the people that read my stuff know that I write a lot from personal experience. You know, The Donors was a medical thriller with a fairly strong horror element, and I'm a former vascular and trauma surgeon, and you know, how did I pull that together? Have you ever seen strange things like that? And then the very common question that you get at book signings and stuff is like, do you believe in ghosts? Do you think that there's? And the answer is, yeah, sure. I believe that there's all kinds of stuff out there that we don't understand. And, you know, thank goodness for someone that writes supernatural fiction. But I definitely believe that those things, that there's stuff out there beyond our understanding. Despite all my education and training in science, I'm very open and receptive to the idea that there's a ton of stuff going on that we don't understand. And it makes for an exciting life, but it also makes for a very exciting life as a writer because you can capitalize on that and incorporate it into your fiction. But I definitely pull a lot of stuff from my personal experiences. As you may remember, I have a very eclectic life, having done a number of things, and I try to put a little elements of most of those things into my work, and then wrap it all up in this big supernatural package. So,
yeah, I mean, were you on a panel? You on a panel this? This year at Thriller Fest, were you not?
Yeah, I was. We did. It was actually a lot of fun. We did. I think it was called "What's My Diagnosis, Doc?" It was basically a panel on breaking into medical thrillers. And when Doug first reached out to me and said, "Hey, you want to be on this panel?" I was like, "Well, I don't write medical thrillers." And then they wrote back and said, "Well, we read The Donors." I guess that's kind of a medical thriller, wasn't it? And now that you mention it, I would think of it more of as like a supernatural type thing. But yeah, definitely medical. It was so much fun to be on that panel and, you know, to be with Michael Palmer and C.J. Lyons and some really big giants of writing, Doug, of course. But also the real fun was all the other folks that were there to attend the panel and asking you questions, challenging you to think in new ways. And I think when you're on a panel like that, you learn as much or more as anybody that's sitting in the audience because they're really challenging you to think differently and you're hearing what other folks say. But, yeah, that was a really cool experience, a lot of fun to be up there.
So now, are you starting to think, okay, because now you know you're three books in and they're all three standalones. Some people might pressure you because it's very, you know, it's been very popular and to start writing series. Is that something that has creeped into your mind, or are you saying, you know what, I'm just going to stay with standalones because of whatever reason, you know, you want to stay with them? What's it going to look like?
Yeah, that's a question that comes up a lot. You see it on panels, you see it in, you know, on ITW's discussion boards. And it's a business as well as artistic question. You know, the business answer is, hey, if you can get a good series like Jack Reacher or something like that, you'd be an idiot not to do that because you develop this giant fan base for the product, and from a business standpoint, it's just awesome. My problem is, you know, my attention deficit disorder. I'm done with a book. I'm kind of done with that book. I'm ready to move on to another idea. And books don't come to me that way. I don't sit down and with a pencil and a piece of paper and come up with this great fluid idea. I love to say I did that, and I'm sure the better writers do that. But for me, it's more like 2 in the morning, you wake up from a bizarre dream. You're like, oh, what if? And it's hard to turn that into a series. Those what if kind of books tend to be very self-limiting. Now, I will say that I'm in the middle of a collaboration with one of my very favorite authors in the world, Brian Andrews, who wrote the Calypso Directive. Give him a little plug. Best science thriller I've ever read. Did you read that, John?
Great. I've not been able to read that one, no.
Got to pick it up.
But
really,
I know the name.
Really,
but I
really
do know
great
who he
book.
Is, yeah.
But Brian and I are sort of kicking around an idea for a more straight up thriller that doesn't really have the supernatural elements in it. His science background, my military and science background, we think might blend well together to do something. And if it works out, that's something that would definitely be a series. And I will be honest, the business aspect of it definitely influenced both of us as we got into discussions about whether we wanted to collaborate on this product, because series sell. I mean, you get a series that works, and that's a good business move. There's no question about it. I just worry whether or not I have the attention span to stick to it. My fourth book that hopefully will be out next year, definitely a standalone, not a series, not based on any of the other stuff I did, completely unrelated. The fifth book that I'm working on now, again, standalone. But I'm excited about trying to do something that has potential for a series for sure. But don't you think that's kind of a business thing? That's almost more than an art
thing. It is definitely a business thing. I mean, as a fan, and this is my own personal opinion, and I don't put anything down as far as people that write series because, I mean, that is, you know, that's what they love to do. As a fan, just for me, I love the standalones because the reason is I know, you know, if I pick up a Lee Child book and I see Jack Reacher, he's never going to die. I know that if I pick up another book, he's never going to die. I like to know that when I pick up the book and I look at that first page, I don't know if anything in this book, what's going to happen from the beginning to the end, everything is open and anything can happen. That's the suspense that I like myself. Now, a lot of people like to read the series because they like the comfortableness of the series going forward and they like their characters. And I think that is great, and I applaud those. But for me, I think there's no better writer in the world ever that I've ever seen in my entire life than Stephen King, because he never wrote a series, unless you want to count The Dark Tower, but that was totally different.
Right.
In the fact that when you picked up Cujo or Christine or Firestarter or It, everybody was on the table and nobody was safe, and that's what I love.
That's exactly right. And I will tell you, I first of all, Stephen King has been a huge influence in me as a reader, as a person, and as a writer, as well as now his son Joe. Unbelievable book that he's been putting out. But I agree with you. I agree with you as a reader, but I also agree with you as a writer. Like, I think that as a writer, I joke about having an attention deficit disorder, and I maybe do a little bit. But when I write a book, it's just the same as when I read a book. I don't know how the ending's going to come out either, and that's fun. Like, if I have a series, I'm sort of within I've got a script I've got to follow to some extent in order for it to evolve into the next series. Both the obvious, like what you're saying, hey, the guy's got to survive because he's got to be in the next book. But also, you've got to sort of lay out a storyline that's going to flow into the next book. And that's genius. It's great. And I enjoy reading those books. But my favorite books to read, like you said, are the things where everything's on the table and you don't know what's going to happen. There's no way to predict the ending. And then it all wraps up. And as a writer, I feel that way too. I like to sit down and know that everything's on the table and know that I don't know how it's going to end. I'm not a big outliner. I don't really know how my books are going to end until probably a month or so before I write that ending. It just sort of flows that way. And so it makes it fun to write. I sit down to write, it's entertainment. It's like watching TV for me. It's like, oh, let me sit down and write so I can see what happens next. And I write better when I write that way. I've tried to do it the other way. I've tried to be a big outliner, and it just makes my work a little bit stale. I'm just not mature enough to do that, I guess. So it's good for me as a reader, but also as a writer to write the standalones. It's a little more fun, I think.
Yeah, you know, I always put it in the fact of, just think if when they asked Michelangelo to do the Sistine Chapel, and they said, now we already got a quarter of it done, so you just got to finish it. That's kind of how I relate series to standalones, is I like the fact that the author has to sit in front of that blank canvas every time and totally create something from zero and think of the whole thing. And that's what I'd like to know that you guys are doing, and that's what you did here with your book, Fade to Black.
I'll say this, John, as an author of standalone books, I totally applaud your analogy.
Thank you. Yeah, that's just the way I feel. I mean, and I know that I'm in the minority. I know I am, because every author out there right now is writing a series, so therefore every publisher wants you to publish a series. And I think if you write a series, it's maybe easier to get an agent, easier to get published, especially if your character is very intriguing and very engaging. I just like the artistic ability to know that the author had to sit there and struggle with that blank page like you had to do, because the intricacy of your work in Fade to Black could not have been done any way than having to put 100% effort into thinking about this, because that is not an easy thing to write, how you have to construct this book. It's not.
Yeah, I agree. Certainly I agree as a reader. I definitely like it better. And all these people that write series, I think that they're doing it because it's what's hot right now. It's what sells right now. I mean, it is still a business, and I'm totally in tune with that. I mean, I'm trying to make a living here.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, and if I had a great idea that I thought would make a nice series of 3, 4, or 5 books, I'd be all over that. But I would never exclusively do that for me personally, just because I think I would lose some of the enjoyment of the writing for the reasons that I said before. I like sitting down with a blank page, as you described, and not knowing how it's all going to end, and not having any pressure from the outside for how it needs to end so that it can segue into the next book. I just enjoy it more. I think I wouldn't enjoy it as much if I did just that, just the series kind of stuff.
Right.
Besides,
yeah,
maybe
I mean,
won't be good at it. Who knows?
Well, I mean, if you can write, you can write anything, and you're definitely an author that can write, so I think that you'd have no problem in writing a series. I just don't know if you would be bored in doing it, because, you know, your books, like I said, are just so intricate in detail and just so, you know, from beginning to end, you just don't know what's going to happen. I think that it might take away from it. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's just, you know, my analogy, but I could be wrong, and half the time I am anyway. Ask my wife. So, you know, you just never know. But, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of great stuff out there. For you as an author, it's a struggle to try to find fans. I always say that right now the supply has far outweighed the demand. I mean, there's so many new books out there that you guys have to find a fan base, and just finding that is almost more difficult than writing the book.
Yeah, that's definitely true, and that's the business side we were talking about. And you know, 100 years ago, you just wrote your books, and that was the job of the publishers and their marketing team and stuff like that. But there's a lot of pressure now that didn't used to exist for the author to be very involved in marketing, and, you know, especially with the advent of, you know, all this mass media and social media and stuff, they want you to be involved. They want you to be doing stuff. There's an expectation that the author is a business partner in their books. And I think that didn't used to exist, you know, in the Robert Ludlum days. He just cranked out the book. They liked it or they didn't. If they liked it, they published it, and then they took care of the rest. And he got back to work on the next book. And those days are gone. I mean, the author is now a real business partner in the success or failure of his book. And it's a whole different type of pressure, especially for someone like me who knows nothing about business. I'm learning a lot about the business of publishing, obviously, because you have to. But that's a whole nother conversation for another day, obviously. But that aspect of publishing has changed dramatically, and it's a whole new element for authors, and not everybody's good at it. There's some great writers out there that don't know how to do the rest, and that didn't used to matter, and now it does. So,
yeah, I mean, I always say back then that's when the publishers could control how much stuff went out, but now they can't. They can't.
Right.
That's the upside,
is the author gets more control, and, you know, some big authors are self-publishing stuff now that they have a fan base and cutting the publishing houses out of the loop. Again, that's a third discussion for another day, but it's a dramatic change. It's a whole different personality type that you need to be in the publishing business now, I think.
Well, hey, Jeff, we got about 60 seconds left. Tell everybody where maybe they can run into you coming up here in the next couple of months if you're doing any events or anything else that, you know, you want to let people know about.
You know, I've got a couple of local book signing things. I don't have any major events scheduled until later next year in the spring. I'm going to be out in California, and I can't remember the dates. But they can always check in with me online.
What part of California? What part of California are you coming to?
That's a great question. I'd have to look it up. Isn't that terrible? It's it's in the Sacramento area, but I'm not
okay.
Positive.
I was gonna say if you're coming to LA, send an email and we'll hook up.
Oh my gosh, yeah, totally. We definitely will. And I need to get out there anyway. My publisher is out in California, so you know, I can always find an excuse to get out somewhere in that area. But people can always find me online. You know, I get a lot of emails, and I still try really hard to answer most of them. And there's always an events calendar. I have to admit that my webmaster is not the best at keeping that up to date, but we do the best that we can. This was the most exciting thing, of course, John, coming up any time in the near future, was talking to John Rabb on Suspense Radio. What can top that? So everything else is a blur for me.
Exactly.
And next Saturday, Doug Lyle.
Right here. Yeah, that's right. Crime and Science Radio coming up
I can't wait. I'm going to put my trauma surgeon hat on and come up with some great phone call questions for him, see if I can stump him. That'll be fun.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, Jeff, we want to thank you so much for coming on. You have a great one. And again, you're in Southern California. You drop us a line and let us know. We'd love to meet up with you.
I sure will, John. Thanks again. Great talking to you again.
All right. All right, you have a good one. Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that is Jeffrey Wilson, jeffreywilsonfiction.com, and the book is Fade to Black. Definitely want to go and check that out. So we are going to be back here with our last segment. I can't believe 90 minutes has definitely gone by this fast. John Rector is going to be our next guest on here. And so we are going to be back here again, 2 and 2, right back at you. Welcome back, everybody, here to our last segment of Suspense Radio. Like I said, 90 minutes has flown by, and before I forget, I just want to thank all of our guests for being on, Robert Rothstein, Taylor Stevens, and we just have Jeffrey Wilson on. Make sure that you check out all of their information, and make sure you check out suspensemagazine.com, click on the Suspense Radio button, to see all the other shows that are coming up. I will say that on September the 18th, it is not on a Saturday, and sometimes I have to do this occasionally with authors that I need to get and I want to get on the radio, that I have to go on their schedule. So September 18th at 10, or at, I believe it's 8 a.m. Pacific time, you're going to hear live for 1.5 hour. We're going to have him here on the show, none other than mega author, because he's beyond New York Times bestselling author, James Patterson, will be on here live with me one-on-one talking about his work and his latest stuff that he's coming up. So I want to make sure you remember that. Right now, we are going to talk with our last guest on here. We had him on last year, and we are great to have him back. His name is John Rector. His book just came out. It is called Out of the Block. So, John, thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, so, you know, it was good to meet you at Thriller Fest. Every other author that I've had on was all at Thriller Fest, and I wasn't able to meet him. But you are the one that we were able to finally meet. And it was great because, you know, we had John last year, and, you know, we were talking about your stuff. I believe it was Already Gone was the book that we talked about. And
yep.
So now you're back here with Out of the Black. So give us, you know, give us that author perspective of the book that might not be on the back cover for the reader. So just finding out, want to know more about it.
The author perspective. It is a story of an ex-Marine whose wife dies in a car accident, and he's left to raise his 9-year-old daughter alone. He's in debt to the wrong people. He's about to lose custody to his in-laws. And he is he's given the opportunity to take part in a sure-proof, no-lose situation kidnapping plot. So you can kind of see how that goes from there. It's sort of a Hitchcockian kind of suspense thriller, a lot of twists, fast-paced, really dark noir kind of novel. So
yeah,
that's
you kind of teeter a little bit on my favorite genre. I mean, I'm not gonna lie. My favorite genre is horror, and I love horror books. I do not like gore, and I always tell people there's a big difference between horror and gore. And so when make books dark, huh?
Absolutely. Completely agree.
Yeah, right. So when you make your books dark and they're in a place, I think I like to feel uncomfortable when I read them, to the fact that I like to kind of be scared. I like to have those nightmares. And, you know, you've written, you know, several books now. I think, what are you up to, like six or seven now, right? I mean, so.
Not quite, but yeah, almost.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, but you're getting up there. You're getting close. You're getting close. I know that you're right. But do you kind of have to put yourself in an uncomfortable situation as an author to make the reader kind of feel that way, because you do kind of flirt there with that horror kind of genre?
You do to a certain extent. I mean, especially because I don't do a lot of gore. I mean, it's funny because this is a debate I always have with my publisher, because I get a lot of reviews, people saying this was such a graphically gory novel. But if you really look at what I write, there's nothing there that's gore. What I try to do is just I try to tighten the screws as much as I possibly can on the characters and make the situation almost dread-filled, and that seems to resonate a lot more. And then what you put on the page is much more vivid, I believe, in the reader's mind if they're just emotionally invested in the scene itself. And you don't need, you know, blood splattering on walls or, you know, guts pouring out all over the floor. Any of the stuff that torture porn and really gory graphic horror novels tend to do. It's much better if you can just get under their skin with a little suspense and just instill that feeling of you know, impenetrable dread and claustrophobia.
Yeah.
That's what worked out with me. I mean, I started in horror. I started writing horror short stories, and my first novel, The Grove, had sort of a lot of horror elements to it. So I love the genre, and I feel exactly the same way. I'm not a big fan of the torture porn stuff or anything like that, but when it's done really well, if you look at books like Sarah Graham's Come Closer or some of the early Stephen King books that weren't, you know, completely gory, and you can see that how he sort of builds, and it to me that's the best kind of writing too.
Yeah, I mean, of course, one of my favorite horror movies of all time is Halloween. And if you look, there's no blood in that movie. There's no blood. You don't see any of the blood at all in that movie. Because it's what you don't see, and it's the music behind it, and it's the feeling that makes you feel that this is my street and I can have a maniac running down it. And so when you're writing your book here, you know, Matt Cane is your main character in here. But when he loses his wife in a car accident and all he has is his daughter, you've already set the stage now to take people into that dark place. And that's a very dangerous place to go as an author, because you can really go really dark if you wanted to. So mm-hmm. how do you kind of have to kind of keep your emotions in check? Because, you know, that aside from losing a child, and I'm a father of four, aside from losing a child, of course, hearing that my wife died in a car accident is probably one of the second most horrible thing that I could probably, you know, have somebody ever tell me.
Mm-hmm. It's a fine line to walk. You know, I've got kids too, and I'm exactly the same way, you know, thinking about, you know, losing my wife or something like that. But you can't let it drop over into sentimentality, or you can't become sappy with it, and you can't go over the top with the violence either. So you do sort of have to walk that line in between them. I found the best way for me to do that, and it's sort of a philosophy on how I write, is just to write as cleanly and as straightforward as possible. You know, whenever you're writing a highly emotional scene or anything like that, the absolute best way to get it across is to write as coldly as possible, as unemotionally as possible, and let the reader fill in the emotions themselves. I mean, I think a lot of writers don't really give the readers enough credit and think they have to spell everything out for them, but I don't believe that's necessarily true. I think if you have a highly emotional scene and you write it from a completely unemotional, cold standpoint, it's going to have such a big punch to it. And that's always what I try to do.
Yeah, because you definitely put Matt into a situation where now he's desperate. You know, mm-hmm. he's desperate to have to keep his daughter. He's now going to have to do something that he wouldn't normally already have to do in order to keep his life, try to keep it as normal as possible after this tragedy. So mm-hmm. the inner turmoil that he kind of has to go through, how would you kind of say that Matt, you know, is good at maybe reacting, you know, to the situation? You know, how did he kind of handle that when you were writing the book?
Matt was kind of a hard character to write because, you know, he's not a dumb person. He's actually very smart. He's just really down on his luck. And, you know, in reality, 9 out of 10 of us, probably more than that, would never consent to taking part in a kidnapping, no matter how desperate we
right.
got. So I had to really highlight the pressure that he was under. And when he does agree to go on to it, it's only to drive. He's just going to be, you know, he has the van. He's going to be the one who's driving, and that's his initial role. And so being able to justify that in his head was a big challenge with this book. And so the first half of the novel, almost, well, not quite the first half, but the first big chunk of the novel is just finding out everything that's falling apart for him and what he's lost, and highlighting the love he feels for his daughter and the desperation he feels in not wanting to lose her, and just seeing the only shred of light at the end of the tunnel is this one opportunity, and that's everything else is absolutely black. So I thought if I could get to that point to where the reader could sympathize enough mm-hmm. and maybe put themselves in that position, that it would work. And I think it did. And then, of course, you know, you have to make things even worse for them after that.
And the book is new. I mean, it just came out a couple of days ago. I think August 27th, if I'm right, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So you have, and it's available. Everybody can buy books. I mean, I'm looking. I'm right now on the Amazon.com page. So people, it's available right now on Amazon. So while you're listening, you can go buy the book, and it's actually on sale right now for $4.99. So you can get it for $4.99. But the one, and I just kind of, I just lost my flipping thought. Oh, so the book is, since the book is so new right now, what kind of, you know, reader feedback have you received from it? You might not have received a lot because it is kind of new. But what's kind of the main theme that you're kind of noticing? Because readers tend to, even if they don't know each other, they tend to seem to ask the same freaking questions. So what's kind of the same kind of theme that you're seeing from the feedback from them?
A lot of people are looking at this like it's the darkest thing I've ever written, and that's kind of funny because I didn't think it was when I started writing it. And even when I finished it, I just thought, okay, this is a nice thriller. This is a fun, like, action. It's dark, but all my stuff is dark. I didn't think this was darker than the other books. So I've been sort of surprised at just how many people have looked at this and thought, this, you know, it's so grim. That's a big one, but it seems to be going over pretty well. I've had some good reviews in the trades, and readers have, I've been getting emails about it, and everybody seems to be happy with it. So, that's about it with that.
And I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with author John Rector, and the book is Out of the Black. You can go to johnrector.blogspot.com to find out more information about what he has going on and to read a little bit more about the book. And you can contact him, too. You can email him and let him know what you think of the book. And how would you kind of say, you know, when you went back and, like you said, you know, your first book, The Grove, and now you're kind of here Out of the Black, what's one, like, the one thing that you can kind of look back that you can say, you know, I'm a different author today than I was then because of what?
I think everybody sort of changes over the course. And when I wrote The Grove, I was writing it for myself. I didn't think anybody was going to read it other than maybe my wife. So, and it's a lot different doing that than it is to consider an audience when you're writing too. That's been a change, but I've always just tried to grow as a writer. I have a certain set of things that I want to accomplish with each book and a certain style that I want to hit. And I think I'm getting closer to that. I don't think The Grove was as tight as some of my newer books. And I don't think I think if I could go back and rewrite some of the parts of The Grove, I probably would, and make them a little clearer. And, you know, just things that you always look back on and think, ah, if I would have known then what I know now, I might have been able to do this a little bit better or a little bit differently. But theme-wise, actually, ever since I wrote The Grove, I've sort of been trying to get back to that kind of a story, that sort of story that's sort of in between suspense noir and in between horror.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's really where my interests lie, and that's really where my passions lie. I don't want to write a full out horror novel, but I also don't want to not have those aspects of the story in there too. So I know that's where I'm kind of trying to go with future books.
And when you thought of Out of the Black and you thought of writing the story, Was it like an epiphany, like something hit you, like, you know what, I want to kind of explore, you know, this side of almost, you know, like of human nature and kind of, you know, the desperation of what somebody, you know, would do and would have to do in order to try to keep their lives as normal as possible after a tragedy like that happened?
When I had the idea for Out of the Black, I was right in the middle of writing Already Gone, and I remember, because it's never happened to me before, I was reading a book on my couch. It was probably about 1 o'clock in the morning, and the thought occurred to me about what would happen if somebody took part in a kidnapping, thinking it was going to be easy, and ended up kidnapping the most, oh, the wrong person in every sense of the word. And all of a sudden, it was like from chapter one to about halfway through the book, I had it all, like the entire thing. And I grabbed a notebook, and I remember writing down the outline for the first half of the book, like the first 200 pages. It took me like an hour, and I had the first half of the book, and I was just so enthralled with it. But I was also halfway through Already Gone at the time, so I couldn't stop what I was doing with that book and jump over to this one. So I put it to the side, but... You know, I've never had anything sort of come to me like that before. There really wasn't any kind of a theme. It was more just like the characters developed, his situation developed, his daughter developed. Everything everything leading up to the midpoint climax was right there. And I really like having that. You know, that's always a good thing when you can.
That's always fun. It's kind of
second.
Fun, but and it's always fun for an author when it surprises you, and all of a sudden it just kind of hits you, and you're like, wow. It can happen at any time too. You just have no idea, and it just all of a sudden just hits you in the head.
Oh yeah, that's one of the best parts about writing, I think.
And are you more of like an organic writer? Are you more of an outline writer? How would you classify yourself?
I usually outline, but when I say I outline, I don't mean, you know, the standard academic outline, you know, 1A, 1, you know, like that. I'm talking about what I usually do is I'll get the idea in my head, I've always been lucky in being able to see where the best place to start a book would be in any kind of situation that I have. So I will sit down and I will write out chapter outlines. I'll just do chapter one and do like a block paragraph of what happened, and then chapter two, and then I'll just go through like that. And I usually will outline about half the book before I get to work on the manuscript. And what I found is as I'm writing along, I can keep adding to the outline, you know, changing things that are already there. But then when I get towards the end of my outline, I'm always about three chapters ahead on the outline than I am in the manuscript, because nobody wants to write every single day. I mean, you do, but when you sit down, you have the days where you're just like, this is the last thing in the world I want to be doing right now, is sitting in front of this computer and writing. Everybody has those days. And what's so great about having this kind of an outline is on those days, you can just look over and be like, okay, I have to write a scene where Jack takes Jill and they walk up this hill or whatever, you know, you want to do, and that's all I have to do today. So you type it out, and then maybe tomorrow you feel better. But you have that roadmap, and you have that sort of guideline to, like, help push you through those days when you don't feel like being creative.
Yeah, I mean, that's very interesting, because not every author wants to write every day, and sometimes you feel authors forcing the issue because it's like, well, I have to, so I just have to get it done. And sometimes that's where I think their writing will fall flat, because you can feel that forced, I have to write, instead of feeling the, I guess you want to say, more of the inspiration that I want to write. And then that's where you kind of see parts of books, you're like, well, this part was kind of like, eh, or this was like, eh, you know, I had to kind of muddle through the middle of it. And maybe that's because that's what the author was feeling at that time. I didn't really want to write. I just had to get it done.
And I know with me personally, if I'm absolutely not a place to write, everything comes out flat and everything it lacks any kind of spark whatsoever. I can usually fake it on the off days, but on the really bad days, it's just when I'm drained, it's nothing comes out. Nothing at all.
Right.
So,
I mean, if I'm told to do the dishes, I'm breaking one. That way I don't have to do the dishes again. You know, it's not something I want to do. I'm just saying, you know, there's always a way, you know, to kind of do that. It's like, hey, I break a dish, and then my wife's like, well, you're not doing the dishes anymore. And you're like, well, thank God, I don't want to do the dishes anyway. So, you know, that's kind of the funny thing that, you know, I would do. So, and also, you have the same thing. It's like, I know I have to write, but I don't really want to write, and so I think you kind of have to feel that. But the good thing is only being surprised is you're surprised also with your characters. And I always ask this question because there's always characters in books that surprise you that have bigger voices than you thought that they were originally going to have when you might have sat down and figure everything out. So what character in Out of the Black was that for you?
Probably, he has a friend. Matt has a friend named Murphy who owns a bar. He's sort of a loan shark, and I thought he was going to be a much more minor character, just basically passing through the story. And he ended up becoming a major force in the second half of the book, and that always surprises me when that happens, or when you're writing along and you discover something new about a certain character. I remember, when I was writing my last book, Already Gone, there was a character named Gabby in there who ended up being one of my favorite characters that I've ever written. He was an ex-con that raised pigeons on his roof, and little, you know, so many little details kept popping up about him that I didn't see ahead of time. And you know, that's one of the fun things, because I mean, a lot of people complain about outlining and saying, well, they lose the spontaneity of the story and things like that. But to me, it's you know, the outline is almost like a first draft to me, and that's where I'm discovering the story. That's where I'm, like, seeing it all come together and seeing everything click into place. And when I get down to, like, actually composing in the manuscript, that's almost like putting together a jigsaw puzzle to me. I know what the story is going to be, but I've got to figure out how all the pieces fit, and I've got to do it in an elegant way, or in at least a graceful way, so I don't look like a fool when the thing's published. And that's the challenge, and that's really the motivating thing behind me. And to me, that's the absolute best part of the entire job is that section where you're like, okay, this is the story. How do I get it onto the page in a way that is going to keep the reader enthralled and is going to keep them turning the pages? Because there's a lot more to writing a page turner than just, there's a structure to it. There's dynamics to it. There's like the cliffhanger chapters. There's, you know, there's peaks and valleys. There's so much into it that you have so much you have to put into it. That to me is as creative as coming up with the story itself.
Yeah. So you're at a book signing, and you're at a book signing here for Out of the Black, and this is all hypothetical. You're at a book signing for Out of the Black, and somebody walks up to you, and they're like, you know, I'm not really sure who you are. You know, should I start with this book or should I start with another one? And you go and you say, here, I'm going to tell you what, I'm going to give you Out of the Black for free. But if you're going to spend your money on one of my other books, this is the one that you should pick up first. Which one is that?
Probably The Cold Kiss. Probably The Cold Kiss or The Grove. The Cold Kiss is probably the one book of mine that has come closest to what I'm trying to do completely. And I think that's a good way to start because it sort of has all the elements. It's got kind of a little horror-y, dread-filled noir element to it. But it also has, you know, I try to put in a lot of different emotions with the characters. I want them to have something that they love. I want revenge. I want, you know, all kinds of different points that I want to hit. And I think The Cold Kiss is probably the one that's the most complete. But I might be biased.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you got to be a little biased. Why not, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, again, I want to remind everybody that, you know, we're speaking here with John Rector and the book is Out of the Black. And so, you know, what kind of tour are you doing? You know, you're going on for this. You're just starting out here. It's the book came out Tuesday. So now you got some stuff ahead of you that you're going to have to hit the, you know, you're going to have to hit the road or the blogs or the radio shows and the things like that. So what do you got coming up? How are people maybe able to, you know, connect with you?
Anybody can connect to me by emailing me at john@thecoldkiss.com. And I do my best to answer all my emails. If I forget you, email me again and say, what are you doing? You're not responding. Cause I will get back to you. I promise. I've done a TV interview. I've got a couple more radio interviews set up, but as far as traveling, I'm going to be at BoucherCon in September. I think it's the 19th through the 22nd. And I'm going to be doing a signing there. I'm going to be at the Iowa Festival of Books in October. As far as bookstores and things like that, I'm not really doing those this year. I'm under kind of a tight deadline with the next novel. But I will – I might go to the Poison Pen in Phoenix sometime this winter.
Okay.
But we haven't set a date yet. But otherwise, if anybody needs signed books or anything like that, just email me. I'll be happy to.
Well, John, I mean, hey, it's always a pleasure to have you on. It was great to meet you finally at Thriller Fest this year. And to, you know, be able to have some face-to-face time, it's always nice because, you know, a lot of authors, I mean, you know, we're kind of recluse. We like to kind of stay away from too many people.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's nice to get out there and kind of say hi sometimes and stuff. So we want to thank you again for being able to talk to you out there. And you're going to come out next year to BoucherCon, which is in Long Beach. Got to remember that.
Yep. I'll be out there in Long Beach, too. Maybe we can have a beer or something out there.
Absolutely. Well, again, John, thanks so much for coming on, and we look forward to, you know, speaking with you in the future about everything you got coming up.
I'm excited, and thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. So you have a good one. We'll talk with you later.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. So, again, everybody, that is author John Rector. The book is called Out of the Black. JohnRector.blogspot.com is the site that you can go and find out a lot more information about what he has coming up. Again, I want to remind everybody about crime and science radio to air its debut show next Saturday on this time slot, 10 a.m. Pacific time. The show is about what Hollywood gets right and what it gets wrong. When you're looking into CSI Miami or any of those shows, how do they get it right? How do authors kind of get it right? You know, what are you kind of writing about? It's the true stories and the true things of what exactly goes on in crime labs and crime scenes, and how, you know, people actually have to work things. And that way it'll make you not only a better writer for authors that are listening, but a better reader to understand where these things are coming from when you're watching and when you're experiencing. So that is coming September the 7th. Again, go to suspensemagazine.com and click on the Crime and Science Radio banner posted by D.P. Lyle and Jan Burke, and you're not going to get two better experts in the field than these two together to talk about these things. There you've got Sherlock Holmes coming up here. We have drugs, poisons, and toxins and death coming up here. Jan Burke is going to be having Marcia Clark on the show. They're going to be talking about, you know, the judging science with the evidence and the courts and all that stuff that goes on, and how all the things happen in trial. So, I mean, it is a fabulous show we're going to be having. You can email radio@suspensemagazine.com if you want to go ahead and you know, find out or be able to email us questions or anything like that. It's going to be very interactive. So keep your eyes open on all of the fronts and everything that's going on there. And, again, we want to thank all of our guests, Robert Rothstein, for coming on, Taylor Stevens, Jeffrey Wilson, and John Rector, who was on here just talking about his book. Again, we will not have a September magazine on its own this year. It will be coupled with September and October, and it will be out on October the 5th. September the 18th at 8 a.m. Pacific time, we are going to have author James Patterson on the show live. You can email radio@suspensemagazine.com if you have any questions you want to ask, and we'll try to get them on the air with him. But I'm going to be honest, you might only get one or two because I haven't talked to him before, and so I'm going to be very selfish and have a lot of my own stuff coming up. Our next radio show for Suspense Radio is not going to be until September the 14th, and we're going to have Suspense Radio One-on-One next Sunday with Charles Salzberg, and then we have September the 14th. We're trying to get filling. We have right now Reba Wright-Williams and Giacomo Giamatti. I'm not pronouncing that name right at all. And so I'm trying to get might be one more guest on there, and we'll see if we can get them on or not. So until then, everybody, I'm your host, John Robb, and I want to thank you all again for listening. This is Suspense Radio. Goodbye.